Can we perhaps just start with some personal unfortunate experiences I've had with expert evidence over the years, not necessarily on the winning side or losing side in any of these things, but they illustrate some of the risks which you have when putting an expert evidence into play. I acted for a helicopter company some time ago that was sued by an owner of a horse, and the circumstances were this: the horse was in a paddock somewhere in Maui or Morwell. My client carried out lopping of trees to make sure that the power lines in the area were safe. And I think TXU, one of the electricity companies, was sued as the first defendant. My client was the helicopter company subcontractor. We were the second defendant. The case of the plaintiff was that the horse had taken fright at the low-flying work of my client's helicopter. Not that it had suffered any physical damage, but that it had suffered psychological damage. That is, the horse had suffered psychologically from the low-flying helicopter, and lo and behold, an expert had been found to prove the point. An equine psychologist or some such. The point was, it must have been about a dozen years ago, this case, but the point was in the magistrate's court up at Maui, and this equine psychologist, I wish I could have dug out the report because the story I'm telling is so unbelievable. The equine psychologist had produced a 2 or 3 page report, and you'll be familiar with branding methods these days. Sometimes a firm will have its insignia sort of in light stamped onto the page, but you would hope that that's done so that it doesn't completely obliterate the writing of the report. Well, this equine psychologist had such a heavily laden insignia, it's sort of like a crown or something over the face of the page, you literally could not read the expert report. Well, that was a novel legal proposition. It shouldn't be admitted into evidence because you can't read it. It has to be undoubtedly right. So that's one example of just basic things which have to be gotten right. But another example, I had a case last year where it was a blood and urine sample case where those samples had been taken, and Racing Victoria had prosecuted a trainer for taking a horse to the races when it's called EPO, or colloquially known as elephant juice, had been found in the samples taken from the horse. And I was for the trainer, and our client retained an expert from the University of Utah, I think he was, Dr. Cornelius Ubo. And he went into a long treatise about why the tribunal or the racing board couldn't possibly accept the integrity of the samples, because what had happened was the samples had been taken from the stables at Cranbourne, taken to RVL headquarters, which is out next to the racetrack there at Flemington. We then had evidence that, and this really shouldn't have happened, but it had happened, that when the samples were looked at by the RVL scientists, the stewards were in the room, and we thought this was a big telling sign against the independence of the scientific testing. Whatever happens, you shouldn't have the policeman in the laboratory when scientific tests are being undertaken. Anyway, the samples went from RVL Victoria up to New South Wales, where screening samples were taken, and they indicated the presence of EPO, but they didn't consider themselves sufficiently expert or proficient to positively identify EPO in the samples. So the samples then went to Hong Kong, and the samples then went to the United Kingdom, where there was positive identification of EPO. And so all of this provided the great Dr. Cornelius Ubo with wonderful, fertile material to say, well, look at the whole history of this sample. How can you possibly accept at the end of the day that the sample that was originally taken from the horse at the Cranbourne stables on such and such a date and then arrives in the United Kingdom some 4.5 months later, that it hasn't in some way been compromised, or there's the possibility of compromise. Dr. Yubo didn't know what was going to happen, which was that he engaged what I would call the ferocious Dr. Terence Wan from Hong Kong. Every time Dr. Yubo went into print and produced a one-page report, Dr. Terence Wan would produce a 10-page report which would systematically and in surgical fashion completely dismember any propositions put forward by Dr. Yubo. And his telling point was this. He said, well, in Dr. Yubo's latest supplementary report, he takes this position. This is very interesting because in 2004, Dr. Yubo was an author in an article which was published in a scientific journal where he had advocated completely the opposite point which he was taking in our case. What's the point of all of that? The point of all of that is Dr. Yubo peddled the case in our favour, and it undermined his independence. When you go to an expert, if we go back a step, what's the role of an expert? The role of an expert is to assist the court in an impartial manner on areas on which the court requires expert or specialist assistance. The expert's role is specifically not to advocate for the client. That's the barrister's job. The expert's role is not to try to put forward facts which will assist the client's case. The expert should sit back in a passive manner and assume or accept such facts as instructed to him, but go no further. Of course, there's an exception to that. Sometimes experts do need to give factual evidence. They might make observations in carrying out tests or performing matters under their instruction, and they do have to give evidence of those observations. But the usual position is that the facts have to come from the lay witnesses, and that's being no more than stating the rule that facts need to come from witnesses with personal knowledge of those facts. I had a case where on this issue of it really comes under the heading of selecting an expert. Don't just get an expert who you think, well, this bloke's going to put our damages claim at $3 million. It's probably only $1.5 million. Let's go for him. Don't do it. The court will never accept it because, of course, the court might, but the strong reality is that the court will scrutinise the expert's evidence in very close fashion. They will look at all of the facts upon which the expert bases his opinion. And of course, you'll have your opponent barrister trying to undermine all of the facts which provide the basis for the opinion. You'll have the opposing expert, which is pulling your expert's report apart in systematic fashion, just as Dr. Terence Wan did with Dr. Yubo. So when you start, don't just look for that case peddling expert who's going to pitch the case at its absolute extreme. I had an instance where it was a loss of profits type case. A contract had been called off, and a typical case where an accounting expert was required to go into the issue of proving loss and damage. The reality of the position was that we could establish earnings in the order of about $1.25 to $1.5 million over the last 3 or 4 years. And so that would, we said, provide a very good basis for the court to estimate the future earnings of the company or future profitability of the company. Our position being that because the contract had been terminated midway through, we're entitled to the loss of profit which we would have made out of the contract for the remaining 3 years of the contract which we'd been deprived of. Now, the expert that was retained somehow came up with this magical figure that future earnings would be $2.5 million. So he was peddling the case, it really seemed to me. The dangers of this, firstly, the court's not going to look at that expert and think that he's really bringing an independent mind to it, because when the court looks at the basic material and financial data, it's going to have these very stark facts revealed. Why would a company which has got a consistent profit-making earning capacity of $1.2 to $1.5 million. Why would it suddenly get to 2.5? Unless there's some very good reason for it, it's simply not going to happen. So what ultimately should happen in those sorts of cases is the first thing that you do is you make sure that you give your expert, your accounting or forensic accountant type expert, they try to call themselves sometimes, I'm not sure what the word forensic adds, give them all of the necessary financial information that they need to make an assessment of what the historical revenue or profit position of the company is. And then, of course, we know with experts, sometimes we need to instruct them with existing facts, sometimes we need to ask them to assume facts. Often that position will obtain in a damages case where if we look at a contract setting, the rule is the plaintiff gets those damages which he would have... No, that's not quite right. The plaintiff is to be put in the position that he would have been in if the contract had been performed. So that requires the courts to go into a hypothetical. So what you do is you need to investigate with your client and then instruct the expert accordingly. Well, were there reasons why your business was expanding? Did you have tenders out for certain supply contracts? Did you have fledgling clients or clients who hitherto had not been with your company who might have come on stream and delivered good revenue and profit to your firm? And then it's perfectly appropriate to say to your expert, look, here's scenario one. Historical sales and profit of the company, or profit particularly, is at $1.25 million. But assume a second scenario. Assume firstly that historical sales or profit data continued on into the future for the next 3 years. Assume also that customer one came online and delivered a further profit of $150,000. Assume also that customer two came online and delivered a profit of $150,000. Another customer three came on, delivered a profit of $150,000. These are all annual figures. So if that happened, what would the profit be in that event? It's perfectly appropriate for an expert to go into opinion on assumed facts. The question will be, for the court always, first, have the existing facts which are relied on by the party been proved in evidence? And as to hypothetical facts, the court needs to be satisfied, was there a sufficient likelihood that those facts would have taken place? And that's all the plaintiff needs to demonstrate. If the contract's been called off against him, he's the innocent party, and there'll be no favour given to the defaulting party who's repudiated the contract. And the plaintiff simply needs to show that these were the hypothetical facts that would have taken place. Can we then go to the next issue of defining the issues? And there's some overlap here with what Eliza spoke about. Experts can be involved in any particular aspect of a case. They might be involved, for example, to look at the question of breach. So in a medical negligence case, for example, well, was the surgeon negligent in carrying out the operation in the way that he did? Usually experts won't be involved in the causation stage, but it's possible that they would. For example, in a construction case, a delay expert may well be involved in causation in a sense that if there's a delay of delivery of materials to site, for example, the delay expert may well have to say, well, what did that cause? Which works were unable to proceed because they were on the critical path, and unless those materials were delivered to site, the builder could not get on with those works. So it's possible that an expert will be involved in causation stages, but not usually. And of course, the third element in your typical causes of action which require you to establish your breach of duty, a causation of some loss, and then the fact of loss and the amount of loss is the third step. That's where the accountants come in regularly to establish what the fact is of loss or what the quantum is of the loss or the types of loss which have been suffered by the particular client. But if I can ask you to do one thing, when going through the steps of retaining and instructing an expert, take plenty of time about it. It's not a half an hour job. Don't think, well, I'm writing a 1.5 page letter of instructions to an expert. It shouldn't take 1.5 hours. It might take you 1.5 days because you're required to do these things. The first thing is you really need to understand what is your cause of action? What are the elements of proof you have in that cause of action? I always do this with an A4 page. List out all of your proofs, and then most importantly, where's the evidence going to come from? Literally, who is the person I'm going to put in the box to prove that that part of the contract existed, or that conversation was held, or that part of the contract was breached, or the following representation was made? There's no substitute for going through your pleadings and looking at the case generally to isolate where all of the evidence is going to come from. And when you do that, and we're in the field of retaining an expert, it will inform you, okay, well, the scope of my expert report actually seems to be quite narrow. It's really only going to go to this issue of breach, or it's going to go to this issue of loss. But you need to go through the process of working out your overall proofs before you can properly understand what the scope is for the expert. We'll leave the letters of instructions. Eliza's dealt with the fact of the factual matters you need to instruct them about. Don't hesitate to ask the expert to assume certain facts. For example, we dealt with this a moment ago, but it's always very well to pitch your case at, well, our loss is $3 million. But don't hesitate to also say to the expert, look, assume scenario two, that the contract was going to go on for a further year. Assume scenario three, that the contract would have gone for a further 3 years. Assume that such and such a client would or would not have carried on business with the firm. Because although, in a way, you don't want those positions to be held by the court, they're your backup positions, if you like, for goodness sake, you have to have evidence of it. So if you only pitch your case at scenario one and that's your highest entitlement and the court doesn't accept that evidence, well, you might be out of court. So always keep in mind whether you ought to be putting up alternative factual scenarios, which involves the instruction to experts of relevant assumed facts which they need to take into account. When I spoke earlier about the judicial, I would call it reaction against experts over the last 15 years, there have been a number of consequences that have flown out of that. One, for example, is, well, the very obvious one is that expert reports simply aren't admitted into evidence in the manner in which they were previously. If there were ever any rosy days where the courts would uncritically accept expert evidence into the evidence in the case, they're absolutely gone, because the role of the court is to critically evaluate the expert opinion, and the court has to be satisfied that the opinion makes sense and that it has a proper factual foundation. As Eliza remarked earlier, as Caroline remarked as well, if you don't prove the facts which are the foundation for the expert opinion's worth nothing. It won't be admitted into evidence. So the first thing which has happened with this judicial reaction over the last 20 years is that make no assumptions that your expert evidence report will be admitted into evidence, because if it doesn't follow all of the rules that are set out in Makita, it simply won't be. The second thing which has happened is that courts will regularly these days deploy a joint experts report. So it's really quite common. Take your typical case of expert accountants arguing over what the quantum of loss or whether losses in fact occurred in a commercial damages case. Quite often the court will have those accountants attend at court, even on the first day of trial, and they'll need to sit in court, be present on the day of court, sit in court, and the judge will instruct them that they're to go away and produce a joint experts report. The report, that joint expert report really only requires them to do two things. The first is to set out all of those matters upon which they agree, and of course the court needs no further explanation. It simply has the agreement of the joint experts under their signed statement, which is then produced to the court. The court's not bound by it, but the inevitability is, and the usual practice is that the court will adopt the matters which are set out as agreed in the joint experts report. And the second thing which the joint experts are required to do is sign off on those matters upon which they can't agree, and more so, state why they cannot agree. This comes back to our selection of an expert point and making sure that you don't get an expert who simply peddles the case and acts as an advocate of the client's cause, because when he sits in his joint experts conference with his opposing expert or her opposing expert, and that's what happens, these people literally get sent off, go to your office or his office, we don't care where you go, but sit together until you can finalise the joint experts report and then provide it to the court, might be that day, the next day, but it'll happen during the running of the trial. If you've got a client, if you've got an expert who has peddled the case of the client in his report, what'll happen is he'll be really compelled when his opponent puts matters to him. He'll be compelled to give ground and make concessions. And the problem that'll have for the barrister running the case is when the joint expert's report is filed and expert one, who's the case peddler, has made half a dozen significant concessions, and expert two, who is the more reasoned and impartial and independent of the two experts, hasn't made any concessions because he's taken safe ground when he's produced his original report. Well, you don't need too much guessing to work out who the judge is going to accept on the remaining areas of controversy in the case. Your expert, who's been the case peddler, has had his credibility undermined, and he's in all likelihood going to lose the remaining issues of controversy that the judge has to decide upon. I think the next topic we wanted to come to was client legal privilege. Caroline's correct when she says that drafts of experts' reports are usually not privileged. The position in relation to privilege is really this. Communications with the expert are privileged, but the reason they become not privileged normally in these cases is because the provision of the report or the deploying of the report in the litigation constitutes a waiver. And so the position the courts take, and it's really following through the Makita point of the court needing to see the reasoning behind the ultimate conclusion reached by the expert, is that the court's entitled to look and insists on seeing all of the instructions that were given to the expert to form the conclusion or opinion, all of the letters which he might have received or documents or affidavits, whatever they might be, so that the court can trace through that methodology or reasoning and satisfy itself, because that's what the court needs to do, satisfy itself that it all holds together. And the point was made very well by Weinberg in a case, I think it was about 5 years ago, when he was on the federal court. It involved a highly technical financial point to do with the economics of introducing increased charges on the EFTPOS machines, and an economist, I think it was called by one of the parties, and he set out in very elaborate and detailed and highly technical language and mathematical formulae why it was that the particular position should be reached that you should not introduce further charges on this FPOS system. Weinberg basically looked at the report and no doubt examined it with great care and scrutiny and ultimately held, I don't understand it. It's confusing. Now, if Justice Weinberg can't understand the report, probably no one in Australia can understand the report. And the report wasn't admitted or wasn't accepted as evidence on that simple basis. So it comes back to a point that Eliza was making. don't be overly legalistic, or for that matter, scientific in the language that's used. Because at the end of the day, remember, a court is a layperson, really, when it's accepting and evaluating expert evidence. It doesn't have the expertise of, for example, an engineer or a surgeon or an accountant. So it's got to understand the evidence really as a layperson, and if it can't, it simply won't be accepted or it won't be given weight. Coming back to our privilege point, we got off the track there a little. There is a decision of Harper's. I think the case is Lintex. It might be a dozen years or so ago, Lintex, where Justice Harper said, well, why should it be that experts' drafts have to be given over? And he didn't. He held in that case that privilege hadn't been waived and that the opposing party was not entitled to the expert's earlier draft. And his reasoning was, why should an expert have the vexation on him of not being able to change his mind? Or and the answer is for this reason. If there is an earlier draft in which the expert expressed a different view, and if there is a good reason why it is that the expert changed his view, well, the expert should be able to explain it. And so if there were instructions which interfered with that view, or there was what they call settling of the expert statement by lawyers, which of course should never happen, well, that should be apparent, and the court should be able to examine whether or not that has in fact taken place. And if it has, then all advantages which go to the other side, either in relation to the report not being admissible or the report not being accepted, should go to that side. The other thing, it's a little similar to, I think we can finish on privilege on this point. Assume when you instruct your expert that all letters which you send to the expert are going to be provided to the other side. Assume that all documents which you provide to the expert as instructions are going to go to the other side. So when compiling your list of documents to instruct the expert with, for goodness sake, be careful that any confidential or sensitive or commercial or privileged information which is contained in those documents, do you really need to give the expert that document or that information for him to form his opinion? If there's risk about it, don't give the expert the document, or at least examine very carefully whether you need to, because you really need to start from the premise that the material will be, at the end of the day, divulged to the other side. You also need to operate on the premise that any draft report produced by the expert will be produced to the other side, and of course it's fertile ground for cross-examiners. The other matter which has happened in recent years is what they call, it's an unfortunate phrase, hot tubbing. The Melbourne lawyers say the phrase originated in Sydney. I think the Sydney lawyers say the phrase originated in San Francisco. It doesn't matter. Hot tubbing is a little like the joint expert reports that we talked about earlier, but it involves this concept that rather than a typical case where the plaintiff goes through all of its witnesses, evidence in chief, cross-examination, re-examination, etc., and we have witness after witness. With experts, you have this situation. Both experts are called and give evidence, are sworn and give evidence at the same time. And in fact, it's a good thing for barristers, because what often happens is that the opposing experts question each other about the matters that they've relied on or the opinions that they've expressed rather than the barristers. And so the judge can, in a very fluid and natural way, can hear the interchange between the experts as it takes place and more fully understand by the verbal interchange, well, why is it that expert A doesn't agree with that position in expert B's statement? Because it really does seem to make quite good sense. Well, expert A's there. He'll be asked by expert B that very question, and it'll give his answer. So it's a very efficient way of dealing with the evidence which goes to the critical issues in the case and the areas that are really of controversy. Hot tubbing is another reason why, because you're going to have at the end of the day this fleshing out or this exposure of all of the matters which went to the instruction of the expert, all of the reasoning which has been deployed by the expert, all of the conclusions which have been reached by the expert, they're all going to be brought out at the end of the day. So you're best adopting a conservative, reasonable, independent position at the start, and that way you'll best able, I think, to make sure that the evidence which you've got is going to stand muster at the end of the day and hold sway with the court. So much for hot tubbing. The final matter I wanted to touch on, if we haven't left anything out and if I'm not in breach of being too short, Greeny, I said to Greeny the other day, well, I thought 15 or 20 minutes was enough, and he told me in no uncertain terms that my obligation this morning was half an hour. How are we going for time?
Got another few minutes.
We might have some questions, and of course I'll take the easy ones and Eliza can deal with areas of trickery. Last issue I wanted to touch on is objections to evidence. Of course, objections to expert evidence. Makeda and Sprowse, Justice Hayden's decision, that's your starting point on all of this, because in excruciating detail he goes through all of the reasons in that case why the poor old expert dealing with the friction coefficients on the heels and the soles and the surfaces that were relevant in that slipping case and why the expert report shouldn't be admitted or accepted into evidence. It's all of the things which we've been advocating in reverse. So what you'll do when you're making objections to an expert statement, your first document's the letter of instructions. Well, has this fellow or has this madam been given all of the relevant facts? I mean, does he really have a sound factual basis to reach the opinion that he has been given? Or is it the position that this expert has really been given some selective view of the facts by the solicitor and therefore we can undermine his independence or his credibility? Because what really seems to have taken place here is that the solicitors sought to poison the expert by either only giving the expert facts which are favourable to the plaintiff's case or omitting facts which the expert, if he knew of, might have expressed a different and more contrary view to the particular client. So that's the first possibility for your objection, whether or not there is an incomplete or partial provision or instruction of facts to the expert. The same concept applies in relation to documentation. Have all the relevant documents been given to the expert? Did the expert see this affidavit? Did he see that report and take that into account? Was he aware of facts 1, 2 and 3 and 4, which we think we'll be able to prove by a particular witness? And of course, you've got two things when you object to an expert evidence statement in this way. You've got to firstly prove that as a matter of fact, that the expert wasn't given the factual instruction or the factual information or the documentation, as the case may be. The second thing you've got to show, of course, is the causative effect of that. And that's to be done this way. You need to explain to the court that, look, if this expert had been informed of facts 1 to 6, or if he knew of this other information, or if he'd read that document, you can reasonably conclude that, and of course it would need to be put to the expert in cross-examination, that he would have changed his view. The next thing you need to show, of course, is, and the view he would have held, or the view that we would ask Your Honour to infer that he would have reached, or the opinion he would have ultimately reached, is X, and it's different from his original report in this respect, and you'd need to flesh it all out. Now, we've left some notes, or we've provided a document. I learnt long ago not to give out papers before the seminar or during the seminar. I had a nasty experience of going down to the Law Institute one day to give a talk, and within about 30 seconds the entire audience is flipping through the paper as I was trying to engage them with my no doubt tedious and poorly rehearsed talk. And it's very unsettling in a similar way to when you provide your written submissions to the judge and the judge is thinking, oh, I know what Stirling's going to say about all of this. What's he going to say on the real point that's at issue in the case? And you can see him flicking through to page 17 where the critical issue arises. So that's why you haven't been provided with the paper, but we've got it here, and please take it away. And if we can perhaps just recap on what we've tried to encourage discussion and thought about, it's to do these things. I think it amounts to four things. Number one, define the issues and take time to do it so that you really know that you're on firm ground in which issues you're calling on the expert to give opinion on. Secondly, ensure that the expert is properly and comprehensively and impartially briefed so that you'll overcome all of the Makita type attacks which can render a report inadmissible. Thirdly, your ultimate aim, of course, is that not only is the report admitted into evidence, and there's, of course, a great distinction to be drawn between whether something is admitted into evidence and whether something is accepted as evidence. Admission doesn't guarantee acceptance. Your final objective, of course, is that the report having been properly briefed, hopefully admitted into evidence, that it carries muster and that it advances your client's case in the manner that you hopefully thought it might, whether it's at a loss level or a breach level, that it carries muster with the court and it ultimately persuades the court that, yes, this expert's opinion is the one that I'll rely on. Because it's no easy test to pass. You've got to, for any expert report to be ultimately accepted as the preferred opinion in the case, it needs to overcome all of those admissibility problems. It needs to overcome whatever attacks the cross-examiner can put on it. And of course, barristers cross-examining experts, it's not a happy hunting ground for barristers. But where they're significantly advantaged, of course, is that the barrister will have the opposing expert in his camp. And so he can really use that opposing expert to flesh out, well, why is it that this expert that we're about to cross-examine, why doesn't his report stand up? What matters can I be putting to him? Please explain to me what process or reasoning we need to go through to bring his final opinion undone. So if I can leave you on that note, I'm not inviting questions, but if they're there, they're there.
You said that obviously practitioners should never interfere with an expert report, and that's understood, but you also talked about expert reports which are delivered which cannot be understood by the court and need to be more in lay terms.
Yes.
What is your suggestion if you've done everything, assuming you've done everything you can before you receive the report to explain, well, firstly, to choose the right expert who can write a report and to explain the obligations and requirements for an understandable technical report, and you still receive something which is overly scientific, I think was the term you used.
What do you do in that situation?
What do you do? Is there room for you to assist the expert in making it more readable and understandable, or do you just have to live with it?
Yeah. I don't think you're compromising your ethical position by merely suggesting to an expert that, look, you've produced this original report and we as lawyers have read it and we find it difficult to follow in this regard because the language is overly technical or whatever the case might be. You can then say to the expert, the judge is also a trained lawyer and he may or may not have the same difficulty. And I think the answer to your question is you need to make a decision as to whether that evidence, that particular part of evidence that you've got doubts about, is going to get through to the judge at the end of the day. And if it doesn't, just say to the expert, look, would you mind turning your mind to a supplementary report and just flesh out whatever aspects that it is that the lawyers might be unhappy about so that we have, and perhaps in some plainer or simpler language, the process of reasoning that you've gone through in that original report. You can flesh it out in a supplementary report and we'll have a look at that and then provide it to the other side. So I think that's what you do in that situation. But really, you're called on to make a decision and act if necessary. Well, if it's not going to be accepted in its in this form, we better do something about it. I think that's the answer.
And I just would like to add there that there's obviously a distinction between clarifying what experts are saying and seeking to get an expert to change its mind on a substantive issue. It's the latter, really, that's objectionable.
But before we have this next question, which I think it's coming, there's a case of Justice Brookings. It's called the Pivot case, but I can't remember the exact case. It's in about 1985. It might have a more convoluted name than that, Phosphate Cooperative Company, something like that. What happened in that case, it was a merger or an acquisition of shares, something fairly complicated. I think it was Arthur Anderson that produced a highly sophisticated report advocating a particular position and in favour of Pivot. Brooking didn't accept the report. He went through the entire history of, and this is on the independence point and the role of lawyers, and it's absolutely required reading. After the decision in Makita, this is the second case which the more junior solicitors or article clerks or trainees must read, because it spells out the obligations by a very unfortunate example. Justice Brooking went through the whole history of communications between the lawyers and the experts, and he basically concluded that it wasn't the independent work of, I think it was Arthur Anderson, I hope I'm not calling them into disrepute by misnaming them, the report can speak for itself. He held at the end of the day that the court could not be satisfied at all that the work ultimately produced was the work of the independent expert. And he even went so far as to find that it had all the hallmarks of being a settled by lawyers report. It wasn't accepted. So another very good example of why the instructions and the impartiality have to be gotten right from the start, because not much point producing a report if it's not going to be admitted into evidence. Is that a sufficient answer to your question? At the back? Good. Did we have any other questions?
Thank you. I'm loath to take you back to hot tubbing, but just a quick question. Is this the format of giving evidence in this way? Is it similar to a political debate? And how common is it?
I'd hate to liken anything which experts did to a political debate, but yes, it is the same. It's just an oral interchange. So it's no more than a much more informal way of engaging debate and the asking of questions and the giving of answers on the matters which really are in issue in that fluid, live way which can take place orally and in a courtroom and which can't take place with a report. I mean, what will happen with a report is expert A produces his written document, expert B says, oh no, but for all of these reasons I disagree with that report and here they are and I'll tell you. Then expert A will come back, well, no, but what expert B hasn't taken into account there is the following. So it's all quite stilted. It takes place over correspondence, written correspondence. It takes time. The beauty of hot tubbing is all of these things can be brought out. Well, what I really want to know and what I want to know now is why. What are the reasons that you rely on to reach that conclusion? And the specific bit I'm concerned about, the judge will say, is this sentence, the second sentence of your third part. So it's very useful to really get down to the nitty-gritty of what's in controversy in the case. Any other matters? Thank you very much for your attendance. You've been very quiet, let alone very patient, and I hope we've been of some limited use on a tricky topic. Thank you very much.